That was the first BBC Proms performance of Granville Bantock's Sapphic Poem for Cello and Orchestra. The soloist here in the Royal Albert Hall, Raphael Valfitch for the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. Well, Bantock did incredible things with the Tower Orchestra in New Brighton as a young man, turning it from scratch dance band to serious orchestra, conducted by Sibelius Elgar and Joseph Holbrook, among others. But he also was very into teaching, became principal of Birmingham School of Music, professor of music at Birmingham University. And the man coming back onto the platform now, Raphael Valfitch, he also is busy teaching this summer, both in Canada at Banff and Quebec, and in Holland and Italy. And I think with Jacques Van Steen already on the platform and a little conversation going on with Raphael Valfitch, we might be going to get some more right now. If the applause stops, that is.
It's wonderful to launch this renaissance of Bantock, and we would like to play Hamabdil, which is a setting by Bantock of the final prayer of the Sabbath service.
Thank you.
Granville Bantock's Ham Abdil, the original title, Hebrew melody. Raphael Walsh's encore with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. Another little bit of Bantock to get us underway for this year's proms. The comedy overture Pierrot of the Minute will be coming along on the 31st of July, and his Celtic Symphony on the 21st of August. Raphael Walsh says he's particularly looking forward to going to the Concert House in Vienna the day after Kristallnacht in November to play music by composers definitely not asked for at that time, Korngold and Zemlinsky among them. Back he comes onto the platform here in the Arbatol. Wonderful smile, Raphael Walsh. Hugely appreciated both by the audience in the Arbatol and by the orchestra, I think. Also going to play the string orchestra version of the Schumann Cello Concerto, which Raphael told me was the original version that Schumann wanted to make. He never made it, but this is going back to what Schumann originally wanted to do. Well, now, there's a chance for those of us here in the Arbatol to cool down before the second half of tonight's BBC Prom. Live, of course, as is every concert in the season, on Radio 3, home of the proms. In the second half, we've another portrait of Sir John Falstaff, this one from William Walton's score for the film of Henry V. There's an hors d'oeuvre, you might say, before the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and Jacques Van Steen begin the proms Tchaikovsky symphony cycle with his fourth, the work in which he confronts an implacable fate. But it's Falstaff who occupies us for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3 from a Proms Plus literary event held earlier this evening down the road at the Royal College of Music, when Timothy West and Desmond Barrett talked to Samira Ahmed about their experiences playing the role.
Tonight, I'm talking to Timothy West and Desmond Barrett about Falstaff, one of the most enduring of Shakespeare's fictional characters. Thanks to Shakespeare, Falstaff looms large in the imagination of composers such as Elgar and Verdi. Elgar focused on the pathos, Verdi on the bawdy humour. Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2 has both, of course, with Falstaff's vital complexity at the heart of both the epic history and the exploration of English manhood, particularly fatherhood. Between them, my guests have racked up five acclaimed Falstaffs. Timothy West has played him twice in Henry IV at Bristol's Old Vic and the London Old Vic, and Desmond Barrett has played him twice in Henry IV, including for Peter Hall in 2011, and most recently in The Merry Wives of Windsor for the Royal Shakespeare Company. Desmond, Falstaff is unusual as a Shakespeare character in that he's physically identifiable by his silhouette alone, that beard, that belly. I mean, it could almost be a panto role. What's the appeal? How do you play him?
Well, I thought you were going to say, obviously, you were ideal casting. But fortunately, both times I've played Falstaff, I've had to have padding, strangely enough, because even Falstaff is larger than what I am. The great thing about doing Henry IV particularly, Henry IV Parts 1 and Part 2, is that they play around about 8 hours. Now, with most plays, of course, you get 2.5, 3 hours to develop a character. With Falstaff, you get 8 hours, and that is fantastic. So you can cover the whole gamut of emotions, you know what I mean? You can cover the whole character very easily in that space of time.
And in preparing, I mean, didn't you wear your fat suit around and you grew your own beard rather than have a false one?
Is that right? I grew my own beard when I did it at the RSC in 2001 because I had to come to this rubber flange in the floor. And I thought if I have a stick-on beard, I could imagine that, you know, 5 times out of 6, the beard would be left down the hole and there'd be a beardless Falstaff on stage. So I grew a beard. And I remember during this period, I went to New York and got to the security people, you know, and they look at your passport. And, of course, I didn't have a beard on the passport. And the first thing this guy looked at me, he said, "My God, it's Santa Claus." And I must admit, I realized how old I was then because the beard was white. And my natural color hair was sort of mousy, I suppose. But the beard was white, and I suddenly realized I was getting on.
Timothy,
I was the right age for Falstaff.
Well, I wonder how you regarded preparing for the role, and indeed this idea that is it a role you take on at a certain stage in life?
You find out who the character is by looking at the text. I think it's very important to have an idea who Falstaff actually is, although we don't know much about his childhood. I think he's very clearly a gentleman, by which I mean clearly that he was brought up as such. I think that he's been allowed to get away with things for so long, argues that somewhere there's an old school tie, a bit tattered and beer-stained somewhere, that's given him license to go on. And I think that sometimes you find in the scene that he has with the Lord Chief Justice in part two, when he's being told off, it sounds to me very like university common room chat. I wonder if they were actually at Oxford together, he and the Lord Chief Justice.
And you've thought of the role as being, in a sense, it's in a play that's about death, is that right, all the way through?
No, I think the first part is very much about life. The second part is about dying. The central relationship between Falstaff and Hal is going off. Everything is running down. The king's getting older and, in fact, dying. The rebels are no longer people like Hotspur. And, rebels in part two are dull old bishops and politicians. That's what makes the two plays such a wonderful round piece of entertainment. Ideally, everybody should see both parts in a day.
Now, Timothy, what's interesting about one of your Falstaffs is, of course, your son, Samuel West, played Hal to your Falstaff in 1996. Now, he told me, my main memory of Henry IV is rehearsing the first scene with Hal and Falstaff, and at one point, picking up my father's script by mistake, he in turn picked up mine, which read, "Palliate the follies I can neither avoid nor deny." And at the same point, his read, "Pick up boot." Does that offer some insight into the character, indeed your preparation?
I hope not, no. We just happened to have our scripts open at the same page, and he'd written this long, long thing, because he that's what he does. He writes a lot of notes about his background thoughts. And mine was a practical thing at this point. Don't forget to pick up the boot.
Falstaff as a character is most memorable in the play, in the performance for his appetites, you know, for life in general, but more literally through drink. And it can almost seem like a moral duty. What Shakespeare has him say on the subject of sack, or sherry as we call it now, can seem like a statement of belief. And it seems a good moment to hear the voice of Falstaff. Timothy, perhaps you'd like to start us off.
Yes. This is Falstaff sitting on a log well away from the heat of the battle, and giving some advice to the young boy who's been given the job of being his page.
"A good sherry sack hath a twofold operation in it. It ascends me into the brain, dries me there all the foolish and dull and crudy vapours which environ it, makes it apprehensive, quick, fortitive, full of nimble, fiery, and delectable shapes, which, delivered o'er to the voice, the tongue, which is the birth, becomes excellent wit. The second property of your excellent sherries is the warming of the blood, which before, cold and settled, left the liver white and pale, which is the badge of pusillanimity and cowardice. But the sherries warms it and makes it course from the innards to the parts extremes. It illumineth the face, which, as a beacon, gives warning to all the rest of this little kingdom man to arm. And then the vital commoners and inland petty spirits muster me all to their captain, the heart, who, great and puffed up with this retinue, doth any deed of courage. And this valour comes of sherries."
So that skill in the weapon is nothing without sack, for that sets it a work. Hereof comes it that Prince Harry is valiant, for the cold blood he did naturally inherit of his father, he hath, like lean, sterile, and bare land, manured, husbanded, and tilled, with excellent endeavour of drinking good, and good store of fertile sherries, that he is become very hot and valiant. If I had 1,000 sons, the first human principle I would teach them should be to forswear thin potations and to addict themselves to sack."
Desmond, how should we be reading that now? How should we listen to it now?
You should find it very funny. I mean, it is one of the characteristics of Falstaff. That's, you know, he loves drink. Can I just read a couple of lines from the first part one? It's the first scene with Hal and Falstaff, and they have been out drinking the night before and slept in late. And Falstaff wakes up, doesn't know what the time is, and says to Hal, "Now, Hal, what time of day is it, lad?" And Hal says, "What a devil hast thou to do with the time of day? Unless hours were cups of sack, and minutes capons, and clocks the tongues of boars, and dials the son of leaping houses, and the blessed sun himself, a fair hot wench in flame-coloured taffeta, I see no reason why you should be so superfluous to demand the time of the day." And that, to me, sums up what Falstaff is about, or what Hal perceives what Falstaff is about. And we were talking about approaching a part. Of course, when you read a script, what I do is I find out what everybody, how everybody describes Falstaff, what their opinion of Falstaff is, what Falstaff says about himself. And then that way you decide which of these things are true, which of them are just suppositions on other people's parts, and you develop a character. But you grow as a Falstaff with the rest of the cast.
But there's more than that, Timothy, isn't there? Because of the part is a man who's full of boasts and who also has lived this great life, which we're not entirely sure about. You can see the possibility for reading into it of a life that didn't quite go according to plan, and a life slightly looking back with regret. And I just wonder how far in Falstaff's you've seen yourself. It's made a difference if there's been a life story like it.
My wife's sitting here somewhere. I hope she thinks that my life has not been entirely like Falstaff.
Has he been a hellraiser? You can tell us.
No, but of course you find things in your own experience. Every part you play, you find things in your own experience, just as you find things from observation of people that you meet or see on the tube or have come across in one way or another. It's never a complete portrait. It's an amalgam of hundreds and hundreds of different things which might give you clues as to how they look, how they talk, how they use their faces, how they walk, how they sit, how they listen. But that's the case for any part, you know. It's not just an extreme person like Falstaff.
Of course, if you have to put on a fat suit, that takes a lot of care of the physicality of the character. You don't have to act fat.
Absolutely.
You become fat, you know.
A key theme in Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, is this theme of fatherhood, and there are these powerfully contrasting fathers and sons, you know, the king and Falstaff, Hotspur and Hal. And Timothy, just, I wondered, having played Falstaff opposite your son, how was it playing the ultimate kind of anti-father, in a way, with your actual son?
Yes, it was very interesting, because it's the play is about surrogate fathers and surrogate sons, isn't it? I mean, the king wishes that Hotspur had been his son rather than the wastrel Hal. Hal wishes that Falstaff had been his father rather than the stern old king. I think Sam and I sort of explored things in each other, some of which perhaps were rather distasteful.
He said you were still talking at the end of the production, which was quite impressive.
We were still talking at the end, yes, we were. Yes, we were, yeah. And we shared digs in several places, yes. And we were all right.
Which is a good point, I think, to bring in our next reading. The love for each other they show is kind of clear in their clowning in Act 2 of Henry IV, Part 1. Timothy, I think you're going to read us a bit from that.
Yes, this is a game that they play at the Boar's Head, where Falstaff is pretending to be the king, giving a telling off to his son, and also advising him on the fact that he's found some rather bad companions. "And there is a virtuous man who I am often noted in thy company, but I know not his name." And the prince says, "What matter of man, an it like your majesty?" "A goodly portly man, i' faith, and a corpulent, of a cheerful look, a pleasing eye, and a most noble carriage. And as I think his age some
50, or, by our lady, inclining to 80. And now I remember me, his name is Falstaff. If that man be lewdly given, he deceiveth me, for, Harry, I see virtue in his looks. If then the tree may be known by the fruit, as the fruit by the tree, then peremptorily I speak it, there is virtue in that Falstaff. Him keep with, the rest banish.
The charm is so apparent in speeches like that. Desmond, one critic wrote of your Falstaff that you captured his easy, companionable charm, but equally that you never sentimentalised his calculating cruelty. Mm-hmm. And what do you make of his moral character? Is he ever really virtuous?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, Hal gets certain things from Falstaff, and Falstaff is hoping to get certain things off Hal. He wants what's the title? Dukedom, and so he hangs around there hoping that he will get a dukedom eventually. So they both are using each other, in effect. And this develops—it's not too apparent in Act One. Although in the scene that Timothy has just spoken that speech from, there's an intimation of that, because Hal turns on Falstaff and basically criticizes him, calls him a fat, ugly man, a user, calls him all the things that we see happen at the end of Part Two, when eventually Hal becomes Henry V. And Falstaff goes to him and he says, the first thing he says is, I think, something to the effect like, I know thee not, old man. And that's absolutely devastating for Falstaff. Suddenly he's been slapped in the face, you know, by this young man that he's loved for years and is not going to get whether he deserves a dukedom is beside the point, but he deserves the friendship of this guy. But of course, you become a king, you suddenly have responsibility. So your history, your past is thrown to one side.
It does seem like the cruelest line in Shakespeare. How do you see it when that's said to you?
It must be a cruel blow, but I think he's seen it coming. I think he's given an intimation of it. I mean, at the very end of that speech, the prince's reply to that speech, Falstaff, still pretending to be the king, says, banish not him, Harry's company, banish Falstaff, and banish all the world.
Yes. And of course,
and Hal says, I do.
Yes,
I will.
We have another reading, Desmond, that... perhaps you could do for us. It's a famous passage which illustrates Falstaff's apparent attitude to honour.
Yes, this is at the battle in Shrewsbury, however you pronounce it. And this scene's very episodic. You see different elements of the battle happening. And Hal and Falstaff come along, bump into each other. And Falstaff says to Hal, I would to a bedtime, Hal, and all well, he doesn't want to be there. And Hal says to him, why, thou owest God a death. And Falstaff's reply is this, 'tis not due yet. I would be loath to pay him before his day. What need I be so forward with him that calls not on me? Well, 'tis no matter. Honour pricks me on. Yea, but how if honour prick me off when I come on? How then? Can honour set to a leg? No. Or an arm? No. Or take away the grief of a wound? No. Honour hath no skill in surgery then? No. What is honour? A word. What is in that word, honour? What is that honour? Air. A trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died a Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. 'Tis insensible then, yea, to the dead. But will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction will not suffer it. Therefore, I'll none of it. Honour is a mere scutcheon, and so ends my catechism.
Thank you, Desmond. Is that really sort of how Falstaff remains at the end, do you think, of part two?
At the end of
part two. Defiant on the outside, however.
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, you know, he's, God knows. I mean, the thing is, he's a man that's lived on positivity all his life. Everything's been not right, but he's made it right for him. And what happens? He gets taken to prison, banished. So what happens then is obviously Henry 4.5, part three. Then we have Merry Wives of Windsor, which is a completely different Falstaff.
Well, let's talk about that, because, you know, Shakespeare famously created the first prequel in seeing the box office potential of Falstaff in the, you know, the joyous days and giving him the Merry Wives. And globally, over the centuries, there's been much more focus on the jolly Falstaff as a kind of John Bull. I wonder, Timothy, is it wrong to see him as a sort of an emblematic kind of un-PC Englishman, which is somehow, I think, how he is seen at first glance by people who don't know the plays?
No, I think there's a special attitude in The Merry Wives that it's a parochial play about parochial people who think that it's quite fun to actually be made love to, or to be thought to be made love to, by a fat old knight simply because he is a knight and from London.
Falstaff in Merry Wives looks in the mirror and doesn't see what he really is. He sees Keanu Reeves. You know, he thinks he's Mr. Even though he's aging, he sees Mr. Gorgeous, and he can't quite understand why these people don't just fall head over heels for him. And of course, they plan all sorts of tricks. They put him in a basket. They throw him in the Thames.
It's essentially a sort of 16th century sitcom.
Yes, absolutely. It's just a bit of froth. Okay. But it is quite sad as well, because at the end, everybody turns on him.
I think, sadly, that's all we have time for. Thank you again to Timothy West and to Desmond Barrett.
Thank you.
That was Samira Ahmed in conversation with Timothy West and Desmond Barrett. The producer was Zahid Worley. Don't forget, there's a Proms Plus every day during the season. You can find out all about them by going online. Welcome back to a very warm Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, where for every concert in the 2013 Proms, we're live here on Radio 3, of course, home of the BBC Proms. Performers tonight, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. In a few minutes, they'll be starting a Proms cycle of Tchaikovsky symphonies. Tchaikovsky wrote his fourth symphony during the most extraordinary year of his life, 1877, when his feelings of guilt about his homosexuality and fear of its being discovered tormented him to the extent that he impulsively married a young student he hardly knew. It was a disastrous step, and within a few weeks, he'd fled from her to his sister's house. He was on the brink of a breakdown before he was able to get to doctor's notes to release him from his teaching obligations in Moscow and set out on a long escapist trip, really, to Italy, during which he worked on the symphony. He'd actually been constructing the framework of the piece at precisely the moment the student first wrote to him, when he was already haunted by what he saw as the destructive nature of fate. Fate, which he said, describing the opening of the symphony, prevents the impulse to happiness from achieving its goal. You can only reconcile yourself to it and languish fruitlessly. The two middle movements of the symphony then seem to move into the realm of escapism. Tchaikovsky said the first of them was about the melancholy feeling which comes in the evening when you're sitting alone and there come a whole host of memories. And as for the famous pizzicato scherzo, well, that's apparently full of the kind of strange, incoherent pictures that fly around your head when you're half asleep. In the finale, Tchaikovsky claims to be turning his back on fate. He wrote, "If within yourself you find no reasons for joy, look at others. Not everything in the world is sad. There are simple but strong joys." But before Tchaikovsky, we turn back briefly to Shakespeare's great creation, Sir John Falstaff, Elgar's portrait of whom got us underway this evening. Now we turn to William Walton as a brilliant film composer. Laurence Olivier, producer, director and star of Henry V, was delighted to have Walton on board. His verdict was William knocked out the most fantastic score. Why it didn't win every award throughout the film industry, I'll never know. And tonight we hear the two most intimate numbers from that score. Touch Her Soft Lips and Part captures Pistol's tender farewell to his new wife, Mistress Quickly, before he sets off for the war. And then comes a lament on the death of Falstaff, based on the Elizabethan drinking song, Watkin's Ale. Now, here once again, Jacques van Steen, rejoining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to conduct those two pieces for strings from Walton's music for Henry V. The Death of Falstaff, the second of those two haunting miniatures for strings from Walton's music for Laurence Olivier's 1944 film of Shakespeare's Henry V. Performed to begin the second half of this BBC prom here at the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jacques Van Steen. So now we reach the first instalment of the cycle of Tchaikovsky symphonies being performed in this year's BBC proms. I asked tonight's conductor, Jacques Van Steen, for his thoughts on Tchaikovsky's fourth and what he focuses on when conducting the piece.
The first movement could be a symphonic poem on its own already. So it's 20-odd minutes of fantastic, difficult, obscure, modern rhythms, far ahead of his time. And then you get the obligatoire andante with a nice folky melody and a scherzo that is pretty unique to play pizzicato that long just for the strings and then interrupting with a whole sort of marching wind band passing by and then a too short a finale. If you look at the score as a first reader, I'm not Rubinstein who conducted it, but I try to be in that era, and if you see what he writes, the clean writing and not my interpretation of doing, oh, we do a diminuendo. Why do we do a diminuendo? It's not written. He knew the word diminuendo. And I said to the orchestra, because the orchestra knows the piece very well, but all with interpretations of the last years. And I asked them to rub everything out, and then you get a fresh approach to a piece that everybody knows. And that aspect I try to achieve tonight, the excitement of the premiere of Tchaikovsky 4.
Jacques Van Steen, and here he is returning to the Albert Hall platform to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony.
Thank you.
Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, ending in a blaze of glory. A kind of musical confession of a troubled soul, the whole work, though, performed here at the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led by Leslie Hatfield and conducted by Jacques Van Steen, who said what he was trying to do was get back to what Tchaikovsky wrote and clean up all the old habits that had grown. And as you heard, they really play for him, this orchestra. He's very happy that they still work hard for him after 7 years. He says they can play anything, but what he wants from them is sound, sound, sound. Jacques Van Steen is ambling through the orchestra to the wind section. David Cowley, who has that terribly exposed solo at the start of the slow movement, going through them. Robert Plain, the clarinetist. Matthew Featherstone, the flautist. Yaroslav Augustiniak, the bassoonist. Lawrence Davis, horn. Philippe Schatz, the principal trumpet. And a special round of applause for Eva Stewart, the piccolo player. They're all going around the entire wind and brass, I think. Next Tchaikovsky Symphony, the 5th on Friday the 2nd of August here in the Royal Albert Hall. Jacques Van Steen off to Opera North in September to conduct Peter Grimes. That should be some show. And he starts as principal guest of the Prague Symphony in December. Spending a lot of the autumn here, also conducting the Philharmonia in Prokofiev and Tchaikovsky, the Coco Variations. As for the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, well, they haven't got long back home down in Cardiff. They're back here on Monday evening at 7 o'clock with their principal conductor, Thomas Sundergaard, Shostakovich 11th Symphony, Prokofiev Second Violin Concerto with Daniel Hope. Well, Tchaikovsky said that he relied on Beethoven, particularly for his symphonic structures. And he said that Beethoven used the dance in his symphonies, so why shouldn't he, Tchaikovsky, use the dance when he was accused of doing so? We'll hear Beethoven's symphonies and the dance in the 7th Symphony tomorrow evening at 7:30. BBC Philharmonic and principal conductor Juan Homena will be performing that work. Also, the dance continues tomorrow night with Spanish Flair, the Fallia's three-cornered hat folk ballet, with Clara Muris, the mezzo-soprano soloist, and Ravel's Bolero, not forgetting a world premiere, John McCabe's intriguingly titled Joy Box. That's tomorrow here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, where every prom is live, but with Jacques Van Steen bringing the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to its feet. Time to head for the calm of Broadcasting House, where James Jolly is waiting to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Thanks very much, Martin. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And don't forget that every prom you can hear for 7 days online via the Radio 3 website. And talking of the proms, here's Andrew McGregor.
A BBC Proms concert exploring the twin keys of C major and C minor. Pianist Paul Lewis plays Mozart's elegant C major concerto number 25. And Daniel Harding and the Mahler Chamber Orchestra make a welcome return to the BBC Proms. Join me, Andrew McGregor, Tuesday night at 7:30.
Well, after the high drama of Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, which ended the proms, something completely different. Piano music by Federico Mompou.
Thank you.
Three piano pieces by the Catalan Federico Mompou, played by Arkady Volodos.
Over on BBC Radio 4.
The principal value is personal liberty. Freedom of dressing as you like. Enjoying a glass of beer in a hot summer day.
As Turkey looks east and embraces its Ottoman heritage, Alan Little examines the tension behind the recent unrest.
Erdogan has asserted the supremacy of his own religiously inspired ideology, but it has collided with the voice of an emerging global middle class.
There are lots of people who are really concerned about their personal rights.
Turkey, the new Ottomans, over on BBC Radio 4, next Tuesday morning at 9.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. And now another chance to hear a programme from Radio 3's Free Thinking Festival of Ideas, which took place last November at the Sage Gateshead. Tonight, Mark Pagel, head of the Evolution Laboratory at the University of Reading, has a fascinating theory about the evolution of humanity. The presenter is Rana Mitter.
Bonjour, здравствуйте, худа, ни хао, and конничива. No. You haven't stumbled into some hellish alternative universe where Eurovision has gone global and we're waiting for the votes of the Indonesian jury. I'm just using one of the markers that makes humans unique in the way that they group themselves off from other members of their own species. And that tendency to group ourselves off, whether it's through using a different language or the rather more extreme method of making war, that might be coming to an end forever. Well, that's the view of our speaker today, Mark Pagel. Mark is head of the Evolution Lab at Reading University and author of scores of scholarly papers. His book, Wired for Culture, draws on his research to argue for a wider conclusion about society, that humans are made for cooperation and not confrontation. And today, he's going to tell us why. So would you please welcome Mark Pagel.
Thank you very much, Ron, and thank you all for coming. I don't think I can top that introduction. I don't speak that many languages. But all of you are aware that our theme this weekend is them and us. And so I'm going to start with a startling fact about humans. We speak currently 7,000 distinct languages around the world. That's 7,000 mutually incomprehensible ways of speaking, if that isn't an oxymoron. Now, 7,000 different languages is 7,000 different ways of saying good morning, or 7,000 different ways of saying, I'd like a tall, skinny latte, please, or 7,000 different ways of saying, excuse me, madam, how do I get to Gateshead? Now, this diversity of languages really sets us apart from any other animal, because we have the dubious distinction of being an animal whose members cannot communicate with most other members of the same species. And so you could say that a theme of them and us is really hardwired into our nature. Now, just last night, coming here in the taxi, I said to my taxi driver, what is this rivalry between Newcastle and Gateshead? And he said, there isn't any rivalry. Gateshead doesn't have anything to offer. And if you think this diversity of languages is a trait of the rest of the world, I mean, there's Gateshead Council prints leaflets in about 14 different languages, and I think there are around 80 languages spoken in Gateshead and Newcastle schools. And there's a market going on across the river just now, and there's a fellow down there who makes leather goods, and he has a sign up, and he says, I make all these myself. And then he has a sign underneath that says that in about 80 different languages. You ought to go down and have a look. Okay, this diversity of languages that a single species produces is a charming and delightful side of our nature, but it crashes headlong into two trends in the modern world. One is that we're all aware that there is a homogenization of language and culture going on. The second is much more delicate, and that's that we might conjecture that it's those parts of the world with the fewest thems and uses, the least cultural and linguistic diversity, that are the real hotspots of prosperity around the world. That is to say, those parts of the world that have subordinated their differences to shared societal goals are the most prosperous parts of the world. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, we're going to find out later in this talk that the homogenization of culture that we're seeing today may not be such a bad thing. And in fact, it might be our best hope for the future. Okay, let me back up a little bit and go to these 7,000 languages, because we have to ask ourselves, as the only species to have invented language, why would we invent a system of communication that effectively cuts us off from most of the other members of our species? And I'm a scientist, and so I'm in the nice position of having the leading theory for the origin of this diversity of languages being a creationist myth. That is, if you go to the Bible, you'll see an explanation for the diversity of languages. It's called the Tower of Babel myth. And that myth goes like the following. It says that early in our history, modern humans got the idea that they could use their shared language to work together to build a tower that would take them all the way to heaven. Now, God got angered at this attempt to usurp his power over who got into heaven or not, and so he destroyed the tower, and to ensure that it would never be rebuilt, he scattered the workers and confused them by giving them different languages. Now, this leads to the wonderful irony, doesn't it, that our separate languages exist to prevent us from communicating with each other. And the real irony is that that irony is closer to the truth than you might think. And we'll see why that is as we develop this talk. Okay. Well, let's try to understand then if this is a phenomenon just located in the Bible somewhere or it's wider than that. If we ask ourselves about the origin of these various languages, we can say, where do they all come from? And you might think that you understand implicitly. You don't need some professor or scientist to stand in front of you where all these different languages come from, because as humans spread out, as we occupied the world, you say to yourself, it's just obvious. Our languages naturally diverged as we diverged geographically. That's a simple explanation for all these languages on Earth. And you can hear it in my American accent and in the differing accents of British English, American English, New Zealand English, Australian English, Canadian English, and so on. These are groups of people who have diverged geographically, and their languages are diverging. And you would be right if you had that smug view. You'd be right about that. But we would fail to recognize that we see the greatest diversity of different languages around the world, not where people are most spread out, but where people are most closely packed together. Now, let's go to the island of Papua New Guinea in the tropics. That island is about the size of the American state of Texas, and it contains something like 800 to 1,000 distinct languages. About 1/7 of all of the languages spoken on Earth are found in this relatively small landmass of Papua New Guinea, as I say, about the size of the American state of Texas. There are regions of the northeast sort of coastal region of Papua New Guinea where you can find a different language spoken every 2 to 3 miles. That is, you can walk along the coast, and every 2 to 3 miles, you'll encounter a language as different as French and English are different. Now, incredible as this sounds, and as incredulous as I was when I first heard this, I just refused to believe it. I once met a Papuan man, and I said to him, could this possibly be true? And he looked at me, and he said, oh, no, they're far closer together than that. And it's true. You can go to regions of this northeast coastal part of Papua New Guinea, and there are places where you'll encounter a new language every mile or so. Now, what is going on? What is going on? Why is it that humans seem to have this innate tendency to divide into small tribal societies that are marked out by different customs and beliefs and religions and so on, and in particular draw rings around themselves with different languages? It seems to be the case that we use language to form a sort of tribal identity. And I've actually found anthropological evidence to support this suggestion. For example, there's one of these groups of Papua New Guinea tribes people got together one afternoon and decided they were annoyed with the group next door, and they decided to change their words for no and yes. They reversed their words for no and yes from Bia to Bune and Bune to Bia. This same group, they're called Selipet speakers, realized that they were just very, very annoyed with this tribal group next door, and so they said to distinguish themselves, they were also going to change all of their masculine and feminine nouns. And so he became she, him became her, mother became father, and if they had waitresses and waiters, those would have been reversed. Can you imagine the confusion, somebody who'd been away hunting for a few days? And they come home and say, did you get anything? No. Wait a minute, that means yes now. Where is it? No, well, I didn't... So you, total confusion. And they did this simply to distinguish themselves from people next door. So it seems we do. There's a kernel of truth to this Babel myth that we use our languages somehow to establish an identity. And I think you all know that, because if my American accent doesn't give me away, if I walk up to you after this and I greet one of you and I say, how do you do, rather than saying, all right, sorry, I didn't get that quite right, that'll mark me out as a them, not as an us. Okay, so this isn't a phenomenon that's just confined to the tropics and indigenous tribal societies. We know we are hypersensitive to accents as a way of measuring our sort of cultural relatedness to other people. And it's something we don't like to admit to ourselves, but in a sense, we are more willing to extend a sort of cultural nepotism, aren't we, towards people who share our accent. It's somehow that they're from the same tribal group that we are. And this is something that we're going to have to come to terms with in the modern world. So we use our languages very much to establish this sort of tribal identity, and this them and us does seem to be a really fundamental part of our psychology. Well, what's going to happen now in the future, if that's what the past has been, if that's brought us up to the present, what's going to happen in the future? Because now we're living in an increasingly globalized world, aren't we, where mass communication, mass transport, the internet, mass migration of people is bringing cultures and languages together as never before, and we're seeing a huge homogenization of culture and language. And the first casualty of this homogenization is going to be, we can sum it up in a very simple phrase, mass extinction. There's going to be a mass extinction of linguistic diversity to rival the mass extinction of biological diversity owing to climate change and habitat loss that many of you have heard about. So for example, I said there are 7,000 distinct languages spoken around the world. It's already the case that at least 30 or so of those languages is being lost every year. That's about one every 10 days or so, a language is being lost, a way of communicating is being lost from the earth. And predictions are that if we just extrapolate that out, by the end of the century, at least half of the languages will be gone. It's probably the case that at least half of those languages will be gone in the next 50 years or so. And some predictions are that 90% of those languages will be gone in the next 50 years or so. Already it's the case that of those 7,000 languages spoken around the world, 10 of them dominate, and most of them are spoken by very, very few people. And you can guess which those 10 are: Mandarin, Spanish, English, Portuguese, German, Japanese, Bengali, Hindi. Those 10 or so languages account for 40 to 50% of all of the speech that takes place on Earth. Now, in the long run, what's happening is that these majority languages are nibbling away at the minority languages, aren't they? It's not that the speakers of these minority languages are dying. It's that the young are voting with their mouths, you might say, and they're not learning these minority languages, but they're learning the next largest language next door. And so the large ones just slowly gobble up the smaller ones. Now, in the long run, and it might be the very, very long run, a single language will come to dominate the world. This is almost an inevitable evolutionary consequence. Whenever you have equivalent technologies that compete for our attention. So, for example, all of you tell time by the same really rather bizarre system of 24 hours in a day, 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour. That's a completely bizarre, and almost everybody on Earth tells time that way. Totally arbitrary way of telling time. Why don't we have 10 seconds in a minute, 10 minutes in an hour, and 10 hours in a day? That's what the European Union would like us to do, I'm sure. Adopt the metric system widely. Okay, so what's happened is that that technology for telling time has taken over the world. Most of us do weights and measures in the metric system now. Not all of us, but most of us do. Most railway gauges around the world are roughly the same. CDs and DVD formats and the way computers talk to each other. HTML, the way we portray things on computer screens, is a format that's used all over the world. So these technologies seep in, and inevitably, when there's a whole lot of equivalent technologies competing, one will win. Well, the same is true of languages. All human languages are equally good at being human languages. It isn't the case that Mandarin and Hindi and Bengali and English and Spanish are better languages. They simply had the good fortune of being on the backs of groups of successful people, or riding on the backs of groups of successful people. And so it will be the case that inevitably one of these languages will take over. Now, at the moment, most of you are probably thinking it looks like Mandarin's going to be the winner, because Mandarin is spoken by at least 800 million people, maybe a billion people, all under the roof of China. But this ignores the fact that English is the second language of nearly everyone on Earth, isn't it? At least 2 billion people on Earth speak English as a second language. And so this is not a triumphalist comment, but if I had to put my money on the language that inevitably is going to be the language, the one language of the world, it's going to be some form